I'm Ryan Miller.
And I'm Brad Carlson.
And we're here with another installment of the Gopher Coffee Shop podcast. Today we've got special guest Jill Sackett-Eberhart with us. And Jill, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you work right now, and fill us in a little bit.
Sure, sounds good. So I'm currently working for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which is one of our state agencies. We're a lot smaller than some of our larger counterparts. And at Bowser, so BWSR, I am a board conservationist. And so that's a person that kind of is more that go-between with the St. Paul and the state and then our local government units that work with natural resources. But prior to this job, I was actually an extension educator in South Central Minnesota, and I dealt a lot with upland conservation practices and did some work with our soil and water conservation districts and obviously the other crops folks in extension.
Yeah, so you're the first non-extension person I think we've had on the Gopher Coffee Shop. We've talked about that we're going to be doing that quite a bit, and so we're easing in as having a former coworker instead of just going out cold. So
yeah.
We've got some other people in mind that we haven't lined up, but you'll just have to stay tuned for who those people are.
But with the goal of kind of building different perspectives and bringing in people that are, you know, kind of more expert in different areas. Sometimes we have to go to outside resources to work through these kind of things.
Well, everybody's got their own role on things. And so a lot of the areas that we work in, we work closely with people like Jill. And so it's valuable to hear what they do on their jobs, and then it allows us to better kind of fit the things that we do. And of course, more information and better understanding is always in the public's best interest. And so, to the point of where we thought this podcast would be informative and interesting, I think it helps us build on that.
Yeah, kind of get us a better understanding of how all the players here in the ag world play together.
Yeah, so and so to take this a little further, Jill, you grew up on a farm not terribly far from where you're at currently.
That's right. I grew up down in God's Country, otherwise known as Martin County.
Yeah, we used to refer to God's Country as that's because no one else wanted it, but sure.
Yep, so my family farm is down there, and my dad still farms. And my husband's family farm is also not too far away, like the Blue Earth Faribault County area. And his dad is still farming, and his uncle and cousin are farming. And agriculture is definitely still very much a part of our lives, even though I've kind of taken a step to the side and work more with natural resource conservation and protection, particularly the soil and water quality side of things.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring that out because I frequently will hear some people in the ag side, some farmers, some ag industry people, be critical of folks working in state agencies, like, well, they don't really understand what we do and so forth. And my experience, there's an awful lot of the people they work with in state agencies, they have no idea the extent of the background they've got in agriculture, and they do really understand what is going on in agriculture and farming, and it's a point I like to make that I think that brings a lot to your job and from our standpoint it makes us makes it a lot easier to work with.
Well, it definitely, sometimes I joke I have to think with both sides of my brains at all times type thing, but it gives, there's a number of us within the Board of Water and Soil Resources that either are farming or our parents are currently farming or grandparents, that kind of thing. And we have a tendency to bring that to any discussion that we have when we're developing policy, grant programs, dealing with water planning and all that kind of thing. Because, I mean, you bring your experiences with you. You can't leave it behind. We all got baggage here. So we can't leave it behind. And that's what's great is that a lot of us do have more of an ag background.
So tell us what your typical day looks like on your job.
Well, my typical day is not being on a podcast, so this is new and exciting stuff for me, but a lot of times I'm dealing with questions related to the different grant programs that Bowser has. Most of our grants go out to local government units that deal with natural resources. So the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, a lot of people are, you know, familiar with the SWCDs, but all of our counties also have environmental departments or pieces of positions that work in environmental work, like septics or Wetland Conservation Act, all those kind of things. We also deal with some of our watershed groups. For instance, the Greater Blue Earth River Basin Alliance, which is a joint powers board, is one that I happen to work with and are able to receive grant funds from us. So a lot of the day is dealing with questions related to that or questions related to water planning. And most of our local government units need to have some type of water plan, which is basically the roadmap saying how they expect to spend state, federal, and local funds on different types of projects.
So Jill, do you work within, you know, I'm trying to get my head around your region. Are you statewide? Are you regional? And are the regions kind of divided up on watersheds, or is it more of a political boundary map? Or
that is a really good question. So as the state is transitioning to more watershed-based research, grants, that kind of thing, Bowser has also been transitioning a little bit. So there's roughly, I think, about 18 board conservationists, give or take. And we have a northern region, a central region, a southern region. And that's just, you're just trying to eyeball the number of counties per region so that everybody kind of has the same workload. But added to that now, as we are starting comprehensive watershed plans, each of us has roughly 2 to 4 watersheds that we will also be working with. My immediate work area is South Central Minnesota. So I have Blue Earth and Cottonwood, Faribault, Martin, and Watonwan, so the Soil and Water Districts, as well as the counties. I then have my JPB, my Greater Blue Earth River Basin Alliance group, watershed group, and then I'll be working in 3 watersheds, the Muddy Bleeding Heart of the Minnesota River, otherwise known as the Le Sueur, Blue Earth, and Watonwan watersheds.
Yeah, I live in that watershed.
You're part of the problem.
Sure. Let's go with that.
Yep, and I am actually pretty proud to say that I've lived in all 3 of them at some point or another. And currently, much of the farm is in the Watonwan or the Blue Earth. So
correct me if I'm wrong, guys. Those are all 3 Huck 8 watersheds. Is that
correct?
What we call that?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is something we talk about when we do our Nitrogen Smart training. Just kind of going through the Huck 8 watersheds. Huck stands for hydrologic unit code, and 8 means it's an 8-digit number. That's really not that important that anybody knows that or understands that. But a lot of professionals that work in this area throw out that term Huck 8, and it's the watersheds that are roughly, they're all about the same size. I don't know what the exact size is in square miles, but the Cannon, the Le Sueur, you know, and so forth.
I think it's 1 million acres, Brad, is what I remember from your program.
That sounds about right. Your typical size county in southern Minnesota is somewhere between 250 and 350,000 acres. And so, yeah, I mean, that's roughly about 4 counties in size, and that's about the size of a typical Huck 8 watershed.
I can't dispute that at all, so yeah. I'm going to go with it.
Sure.
Sounds good.
Okay. Okay.
But you're correct, and I try not to use too much jargon, but so those 3 are my Huck 8s.
So moving forward, what kind of work are you looking at doing in those watersheds?
So in order for a soil and water conservation district or a county to receive grant funds from Bowser, they need to have, in the past, they needed to have a county water plan. And those were updated every 10 years with an amendment, if needed, at 5. And what we're finding, in no surprise, is that a drop of water does not stop at the county line. You know, it goes with its geology and hydrology. And so we've started with the hope that transitioning to watershed planning, it'll make the implementation money, the practices that we put out on the land, more, more bang for your buck, and not quite so scattershot because you're looking at where that water or that soil is going. So as we move into that, it's a mindset change, because you're not just working with the people you've always worked with in your county office, or the people you've always worked with across town at the soil and water office. You're bringing in sometimes up to, you know, mine in the Watonwan watershed, we have 6 counties and 6 soil and water conservation districts, along with their boards and along with all the agencies that work with them. I mean, that's a lot of people that you sit down with and try to come to a consensus on what you would like to see done in the next 10 years.
It is, but I think the direction that we're going with conservation work in Minnesota right now is, it's starting to play out, and long term has a chance to be significantly more effective than what we've done in the past. And you know, I've been somewhat critical, you know, as I've been in extension now for 25 years, that historically we did a lot of conservation work that was just shotgunned out on the landscape. It was really conservation by the willing. It was whoever wanted to do something would come into the, you know, the NRCS, the SWCD office and say, you know, I want a wildlife pond. And they'd say, oh, okay. You know, but there was never really anything strategic about it. There was never any thought that we have this specific resource concern in this area, and this is particularly the things we need to be doing to address these to make everything better, or to see improvement, I guess is what I really should be saying. And I think the direction that we've headed now in the last decade plus is really getting us to the point where we're actually targeting a lot of the conservation efforts and funding into things that are a lot more specific to the particular issues that we find statewide, but more importantly, in any given local area.
I can't disagree with your thoughts at all. I mean, that's what we've heard over and over again. And just because we are switching to comprehensive watershed planning doesn't necessarily mean our soil and water conservation districts aren't still going to be able to work with individuals that say, I have a problem, I'm more than willing, can we somehow do this? We're just saying that we're going to be trying much more to be a little bit more strategic on prioritizing a resource concern, and then targeting a specific area or specific types of practices or specific impairment or something that we're able to say that by the end of this, hopefully we'll be making a difference, whether it's improving or protecting, because we do still have water and soil resources, natural habitat that we should be protecting down here. You think maybe up north a little bit more protection, but we got some protection down here too.
Well, it seems like the process is going to open the door to maybe doing some better measurement of outcomes and things, and say, hey, these practices that we implemented on these acres or whatnot led to this kind of outcome with water quality or whatnot.
Right. And that's what the hope is. And it goes back to kind of your comments at the beginning when we first started talking here. A lot of the universities, MNSCU, are the Department of Health, the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Ag, Bowser, DNR, all of us actually working together are really, it's becoming a much more conglomerate of work. The PCA is doing monitoring to set baseline, and then hopefully they'll have funds to monitor again in 10 years or so and say, did any of the work that you did on implementation make a measurable change in phosphorus levels in the main fork of the Watonwan River, that kind of thing. And we can't do that without the research the university folks are doing or that ARS is doing. So as we move forward with this, at least in the state of Minnesota, we're all going to be working more and more on this.
Well, and I know that, and you've heard it too, that there's been a lot of people critical in the past of the way we deal with environmental issues in Minnesota because of the number of players that are involved. And there's a lot of history on how that evolved and how it got that way. But what I always say about it is it actually allows us to customize an approach locally based on what's going on and who the players are. So instead of you get to some other state that's got some master environmental entity that does everything, they also have the tendency to one size fits all. This is just how we do things. Versus in Minnesota, we've got the ability to to say, you know, for instance, this part of the state, we're dealing with shallow cold water streams. In this part of the state, we've got shallow lakes. And, you know, in northern Minnesota, we've got mercury problems in the water, which is, you know, 180 degrees different from the things we deal with in the southern part of the state. It really allows us to have an approach that kind of fits what's going on locally and how we might deal with it.
Another kind of important factor I think you're getting at, too, is that the cropping system is going to vary. So what might be real practical over in southeast Minnesota, some practice you might want to implement, it might not be as practical in south central or southwest based on the different kind of systems we run, which we think of things being pretty uniform and monotonous, but it's actually fairly different when you travel across the state and look at different, you know, what kind of agriculture is happening and how they're doing it. So,
right. I mean, it's similar to what we talk about with nitrogen management because of the climatic differences going from the eastern side of the state to the western side of the state, as well as from the south to the north. We do need to be pragmatic with all of these conservation practices and fit things to the specific landscapes. I was privy to a presentation that was done at the University of Minnesota's Water Resources Center to a staff group back a couple of months ago. And granted, this was modeled data. It wasn't really actually measured out in the field, but they were looking at the concept on a particular, and I think it was Seven Mile Creek. So we're really, you know, quite close within a few miles of that watershed where we're sitting right now. But they were looking at data that indicated that probably 20% of the acreage in that watershed having certain conservation practices were going to meet 80% of their water quality targets. And so, again, when you start talking about customizing an approach, if we get technology to the point where we can start identifying very specifically which practices need to go where to have the most benefit, we absolutely are going to have a customized approach to how we deal with this stuff.
And when it comes to this watershed planning, what we're trying to do is keep the process the same, but understand that something that gets put into a comprehensive watershed plan in southeast Minnesota, like down in the Root River watershed, isn't necessarily going to be to fit at all in the Missouri River watershed over on, you know, dealing with totally, we tend to think of Minnesota as this nice Midwestern, you know, community and think of it as small, but it's big, isn't it? Like the 12th state or something like that geographically. And
I'll go with that.
We have a lot of variability from precipitation to soils to temperatures to crop, which then of course affects our cropping and even our natural habitat and wildlife populations are, you know, what we have up north. You're not going to see too many porcupines wandering around south central Minnesota, but yeah, you can see them dead on the road up in, you know, up by Brainerd.
Right. Yeah. We were up in at the Research and Outreach Center in Crookston for our nutrient management group back a couple of months ago, and corn production up in that part of the state is relatively new. I mean, there's been some corn in the Crookston area for maybe a couple of decades, but when you get north of Crookston, I mean, I remember doing a meeting in Kitson County 8 years ago, and farmers there were asking me about just the simplest things. Well, how deep do you plant it? And, you know, well, what kind of weed problems? Very, very basic, and they didn't even know that stuff. But anyway, so because of the short history we've got with corn production in that part of the state, we don't have a lot of research. And so we started to put in nitrogen rate trials in Crookston, and the last 2 years, our corn following soybean plots have not been responsive to nitrogen. So,
wow.
Yeah. So again, you talk about customizing an approach. If you've got a cropping system where, I mean, lo and behold, I mean, who could think you could plant corn and not fertilize it and get your maximum yields? And that may not be sustainable in the long term, but at least at the moment, you know, and so again, it kind of goes back to how we address these things are going to be very different in different parts of the state.
Well, right, and you bring up that point, Brad, and it may open the door for some technology that doesn't work in southern Minnesota to be used in northern Minnesota. And I think some of our counterparts, the specialists on campus, are doing some of that work, you know, with, I'm just thinking of sensors that we know haven't shown a history to work for nitrogen applications in southern Minnesota. By the time our sensor sees a difference, we're experiencing a yield loss and it's too late, too, you know, and that kind of concept. But maybe in Crookston, that's going to be an application, you know, just thinking out loud, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and then moving into another area, Jill, an area you've got quite a bit of expertise in, and that's cover crops and how we potentially adapt the use of cover crops across the state of Minnesota. There's going to be some huge regional differences in that.
For sure. I can honestly say I could sit and talk about and listen about cover crops all day long, because who and where you are talking to, totally, you hear different stories. And it also comes down to their rotation, and do they use anhydrous, or do they use urea, or do they use it all? It's so interesting to listen to this, but it's going to be different. And a lot of times I think we have a tendency to want immediate results and I want like a cookbook recipe that you can go out there and do it. And what we're finding, at least with something like cover crops, is you can kind of have like a grocery list of options, but what the cookbook recipe says for somebody in Houston County is not necessarily what the cookbook recipe needs to be for somebody in Big Stone. There's going to be similarities. We're all, in general, working towards a small handful of the same goals, like, you know, soil erosion reduction or better management of nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, maybe some grazing opportunities. But again, in South Central Minnesota, how many people are grazing it versus up in West Central Minnesota or even Central Minnesota? So you're going to use different species and you're going to plant at different times. And that's what's so great about having a wide group of entities and people working on something like cover crops, because then you can share this information, because it's not going to be a really quick and easy yes, no, check the box type practice to work with.
So where are you guys at? Where's Bowser at with cover crops? What kind of things you got going on right now?
So let's see here. I started with Bowser in 2016, and that was right around the time that, at least as far as I can remember, Bowser's state cost share policy changed to actually allow non-structural land management practices. And so for those of you that are more familiar with the NRCS terminology, they would term it the ecological practices, one of which is cover crops, but you could also, the reduced tillage, would nutrient management, those would be three good examples. And so that was a huge policy change to that grant program, because for the longest time we were only able to do structural practices with a cost effective life of 10 years or more. Well, anything that's more in field and non-structural and more ecological, you can't, you know, it's basically 1 year at a time. So that was huge. At the same time we did that, we also changed a little bit in our Clean Water Fund policy, which is the amendment money, the 3/8 of 1% of the tax revenue. But we also included the option to utilize the non-structural land management practices like cover crops in that as well. So that has you... It really stemmed from SWCD saying we have landowners coming in and maybe they can't get signed up for EQIP, or maybe they don't want to go through the paperwork or the delayed process with NRCS and they would rather do something quicker. And I would say that Bowser Senior Management was listening. And I was really happy that I started at the same time that happened, because I used to argue a lot with other Bowser people about why I couldn't get grants to cover crop work. So now we can.
Well, and there's a lot of interesting work. I'm sure we'll address that on future podcasts, Brad, but I know some of the work they're doing at Waseca with looking at different water quality parameters and looking at cover crops and their influence on some of those. Jeff Vetch, I'm thinking about that study that it's really kind of in its infancy. They've got 1 or 2 years of data now, but a lot of interesting things happening in that arena in terms of measuring what the real world impacts can be from utilizing cover crops.
Well, one of the things that's really consistent with a lot of the research is that cover crops do scavenge nitrate. So you're talking about the study on the drainage plots at Waseca, where they grew cereal rye, so therefore it greened back up in the springtime. They were able to reduce or saw a reduction in the amount of nitrate running out of the tile water by 50%, cut it in half. Didn't see the same reduction, though, with a annual cover crop mixture that died in the fall. So,
you know, important to know.
It is important to know, because if we're trying to hit some water quality objectives with this, I mean, a lot of people look at those annual cover crops, the radishes and some of those, as having the best soil health benefits. But, you know, from a big picture standpoint, I think a lot of folks are saying, well, you know, if we're not going to get some greater societal benefits too, like reduced, you know, nitrates in the water, you know, maybe we need to be looking in a different direction. So anyway, we've seen that. And then a lot of the other projects I've looked at, of course, we don't have the luxury of having them on top of drain tile where you can collect the water. So instead you take soil samples and you just look for residual nitrates. And we are seeing significant reductions in the amount of residual nitrate left in the soil profile also where we grow cover crops. The thing I think from a soil scientist standpoint that we don't really have worked out yet is what's really going on with that nutrient cycling. Because technically speaking, if the cover crops are taking up that nitrate and holding it on site, it should potentially reduce the amount of fertilizer you should be applying next year because you've retained more nitrogen in the system, but that's really not bearing out in a lot of the research projects. In fact, the one at Waseca showed that they actually needed to fertilize 30 pounds higher of nitrogen to get the same yield. The 30-pound higher fertilization rate resulted in lower nitrate loss in the water. But that was now the question is that a one-time effect because we've slug loaded all this carbon into the soil and maybe over time that'll go away, or do we have something else going on with nitrogen cycling where we're picking up the nitrogen but it's not ending up being usable for next year's crop? I don't think we got that worked out quite yet. So there's still a lot of questions left.
Another important topic, Brad, because if we can make a change to management if necessary and see the benefit and also get, a crop that's not deficient in nitrogen, you know, because if we don't learn these kind of things, and a producer might get turned off from using a cover crop because they end up with maybe a lower yield or something of that sort. But if they can kind of figure out if it's a one-time situation or maybe it's an amendment to the corn crop management in the year following. I mean, those are important things to figure out, particularly if they're having such a great impact on, you know, subsurface loss of nitrate through the tile lines. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I've been real encouraged with what we're seeing so far for data. The other part, though, this is kind of getting off on a tangent that's not really relevant to having Jill with us here today, but overall, we've seen the amount of nitrate coming out of those tile lines at Waseca going down drastically over time. We need to kind of get a handle on what's going on there to see if that can or will be replicated across the landscape, because we've been consistently seeing nitrate concentrations in the tile water at below 10 parts per million now for several years, which, of course, that meets federal clean drinking water standards, which, of course, we're not advocating drinking the water coming out of a tile line, but for nitrates, it's actually would be acceptable at those levels. And so I think there's a lot to, we do a research project and we, of course, study our specific variable, in this case cover crops, but then there's some other big picture things going on that we also got to get a handle on. I think going back to that whole big picture thing, Jill, comes back to this whole soil health issue. which is all interrelated with the cover crop thing. What's your perspective on the whole concept of soil health? I know it's that's a pretty large open-ended question, but I'd like your thoughts.
You know it when you see it, right?
Yeah, well, so obviously, I think for many of the listeners today, they probably have heard of soil health and the practices in general that one tends to think of that helps increase soil health or soil tilt or soil quality, however you personally want to think about it, would be things like cover crops, extending your rotation, reduced tillage and to the point of such as strip till, no till, including livestock potentially. But kind of the big ones are the cover crops, the reduced tillage, and in my mind, extended crop rotations. Soil health, we have soil health parameters, soil health assessments that can be done. One of the big ones is infiltration testing. And of course, we do have some biological soil tests that we are still trying to figure out if they really need to be calibrated and standardized for all areas of the United States, not just, you know, Texas, where some of them got developed and that kind of thing, because we're not necessarily getting the same results. It's going to be difficult, I think, and we wanted the answers yesterday. And it comes back to cover crops, too, where we wanted the answers yesterday. We wanted to know exactly what mix to plant and how deep and how to do it and what herbicides can work and what ones can't and the residual levels and how much nitrogen can you get each year, expect to get, and when is it released? Because if it's released too soon, you're not going to use it, released too late, blah, blah. You know, I'm preaching to the choir here. So I'm all about it, and I've just totally geeked out. I've nerded out here for a second, but it's going to be incredibly important, and I think consumers want it because some of our larger food companies and beyond, consumer companies in general, are getting pressure and saying we want green standards for our products or green standards for the production of our, you know, peas and sweet corn. And so it's not just the ag community that is talking about this anymore. I honestly feel that it's just going to keep growing. And the thing about something like cover crops is a lot of our practices, our conservation practices, are good at doing one or two things. You know, it's good at like a bioreactor. You know, it's good at then doing what it was designed for, which was working with nitrogen. But what is it going to do for soil erosion, surface soil erosion problems or phosphorus problems? That's not what it was designed for. Well, something like a cover crop, it can help with soil erosion. That's the easy one that it can help with, but it can help with phosphorus, it can help with nitrogen. And so that's why I get excited about some of those soil health practices, because they often can assist in more than just one pollution of concern.
And I want to go into just a little bit more detail about something you touched on there at the beginning of your comments, and Ryan alluded to it also earlier, and that being the part about we wanted the answers yesterday. You know, we got a segment of the farming public out there who loves innovation and they really want to grab things and run with it. The thing that I get scared about is when there's a lot of these details that we don't really have worked out yet, is what their actual tolerance is for some of those things. And if they have a high tolerance level, that's fine, as long as they understand that there's going to be some problems and some things that weren't worked out. But also the, you know, kind of the risk level is we got to be very careful about people doing things that could end up failing. I don't know that failure is the exact word, but we've Ryan and I have seen, for instance, moving away from cover crops, on the precision ag side, we've seen technologies get rolled out that actually weren't really well researched. And you have people, there's been actually a couple of pretty spectacular bankruptcies in the Midwest of people who just bought whole hog into a new technology that had a theory behind it, but no actual proven data. And so that's the one thing I would say about the whole cover crop stuff is, The research is indicating a lot of promise, and we've also gotten to the point where there's some things we know you can do that work really well, but it's not all there. And so I caution farmers particularly from jumping in with both feet without actually finding out where those limitations are, where the things are that we don't really have worked out, just so you don't set yourself up for disappointment or for some financial hardship.
And I think one of the things that we're seeing in the Midwest and in Minnesota is that it's almost helpful to have a mentor program type thing, because the early adopters at this point in time, at least with something like cover crops, most of them have done their own, you know, on-farm research or demos and worked with it, and they're feeling really comfortable with it. But your average person might not want to do that and might not be willing to take the year that they end up with a 20 bushel hit or the year where they have to spray, you know, have an additional herbicide or, you know, something that requires an additional cost. But there's so many people that are out there that have done it for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. We just need to get the people who are interested in touch with the people who have that. And so many of them are willing to, you know, to share what they know. But you have to get connected and take the time to do it.
Brad, some reason, I just thought of this. I remember back, it was many years ago, you were working in Rice and Steele counties, and we were having that long-term tillage trial that we were doing with Mark up in Rice County. Yeah. And that was probably one of my first insights of soil health. I don't think we were even using that terminology at that point.
No, it was probably soil quality was more used at that. Yeah,
but it was pretty impressive because we had different tillage systems we were using for continuous corn production, mm-hmm. and so I think we ended up with like 8 years on that site
yeah.
with growing corn and looking at reduced tillage systems along with the more aggressive. You know, we had moldboard plow and mm-hmm. chisel plow and. It was kind of eye-opening because we go out there occasionally to take stand counts or measure plant height and whatnot. And we were out there one time. I don't know if you were with me or if Tim Arlt was with me, but we were taking some measurements and early in the season, and we had a pretty significant rain shower the night before. And just to note the differences in water infiltration, you couldn't walk across some old board plowed strips, but on our strip till plots, you know, you could walk out there with no problem, you know, just kind of an interesting insight. And it seems like kind of for some reason that was on the radar screen for quite a bit as far as reduced tillage and things. And I don't know why we kind of hit a wall with seeing further adoption of, you know, something like strip till that, you know, you're only tilling what 8-10 inch bands in right. the soil. And pretty impressive to look at the, at least from my anecdotal looking at those systems, improvements in water infiltration and you know, if I'm remembering correctly, I have to dig back to the research reports, but in southeast Minnesota, we were able to maintain fairly similar crop yields between the different tillage systems. So,
well, I've long questioned why strip till hasn't gained a higher level of popularity, you know, at a faster rate. The one thing I would say is, you know, unlike some things of the past, if we went back to, there was a fair amount of no-till was tried in the 80s, back when it was a lot drier. And of course, ridge till also gained some popularity back about that time. Those were two tillage systems that came and went. People did them and then abandoned them. I don't see strip tillers saying, well, this doesn't work for me, I'm not going to strip till anymore. We haven't seen that. So the people that strip till are happy with it, and they're not going away from it. It's just more of an issue of the folks who don't strip till haven't really seen the advantage or been motivated to switch to that. But it we've definitely seen a lot of those soil quality aspects in those fields.
And you know, I'm trying to think a lot again here, but maybe part of the reason would be the availability of technology and guidance technology wasn't really there. I mean, it was kind of cost prohibitive back when we were doing that. I know Mark was fooling around with RTK technology, and we know from different research that that can really help, you know, put us right back on that tillage strip with the planter. And now that some of that stuff is getting pretty approachable in terms of cost, you know, for an operation of moderate size, I wonder if that will help kind of shepherd things along.
It might. I think the wave of autonomous agriculture, we're right on the cusp of that. It's going to be interesting to see how that changes a lot of this stuff. I could see autonomous agriculture making strip till much more of a reality, because the requirements to till a single row versus full width are so much less. There would be an advantage to that. The ability to actually go between rows and seed a cover crop are there, and so forth. You know, a lot of the systems we have in agriculture right now have developed not just from a production standpoint, but also from a time management and resource management standpoint. And so if we change the paradigms related to the amount of time and resources necessary, because I'm not convinced that, you know, our standard use a ripper and then, you know, run out there with 15% residue and plant your corn with a 36 row planter, I'm not convinced that's the best way to do it. I'm certainly not telling you that it's a failure either, because it works and there's, you know, a large percentage of people growing corn that way. But what I am saying is, if the alternatives suddenly become much more attractive, maybe it tips the balance that we're going to see some switches to some other things. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here.
Yeah, and talking about water, this is a big year. I mean, everyone's complaining with how much water we had. And if we can increase the number of field working days by having a field condition where we get better infiltration of water and make it so we can get into the field sooner to do our other crop activities like spraying a herbicide or what have you, I don't know, there could be some upside to that too, I guess.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah, we have the Faribault County, they call themselves the Faribault County Soil Health Team, and there's a number of them that have experience with cover crops and strip till, no till, and or all of it. I think they may actually affectionately call themselves the strip club every once in a while when they meet for coffee. But when you talk to some of those guys, like down there, they are saying all the same things. You know, the co-op was able to get in and spray 2-3 days earlier than my, you know, the next door neighbor this year, and I swear it's because of the condition of my soils, because of the strip till, or because of the cover crops. And and like you said, a lot of this is anecdotal. You're not necessarily going to do your standardized soil test and it's going to say, hey, you should be able to drive out there earlier than everybody else. No, it's still just going to be your standard soil test. And that has been the good and the bad when it comes to these soil health practices, because we are used to the chemical physical soil test. That's what we're used to. And we feel really good about the data that we get from that and the numbers that we get. We feel it's reliable. But here we are all of a sudden talking about these things that don't show up on a report super fast.
That's tough to measure, because I remember back in the day when we were talking about that tillage study, we were looking at fuel use. I mean, fuel was hugely expensive back then, and so we were looking at reductions, and that was a part of the focus, was like this reduction in fuel use just from a just purely checkbook standpoint. You know, I can potentially have some savings by reducing how much tillage I'm doing. And now you got these other things. I don't know. It's tough to get accounting of, but it'd be interesting to get an economist to kind of dig in on some of these things and try to put some book value to it, because I don't know, it might be easier to adjust things then.
Yeah, and one of the things Jill's talking about, if we could improve the technology for measuring some of this stuff, that would help a lot too. We've long known that soil biological activity is very important, but there's just never been a number. You know, it's, you can't bag your soil sample up and send it to the lab and get a number and say, yeah, well, I did this and my number went up and it got better. We just knew that it was a real thing, you know, and similarly water infiltration. I mean, a topic I've talked to farmers about my entire career, I've talked about, because most farmers have had this experience. Take a heavy rainfall, inch plus, 2 inches, go out in the windbreak or on a fence line and dig a hole, and you'll discover you can do it. You can, and the soil breaks apart fine. It's loose. It's whatever. Go out in your farm field after an inch rainfall with a shovel and try and dig a hole. So there can be no doubt that the way we are growing our agricultural crops right now do not lead to good soil structure, which of course goes back to water infiltration. It goes back to root exploration of the profile and therefore better and more efficient use of our applied fertilizers. And lots of host of other things, reduction in soil erosion, both water and wind, and so forth. So I think if we can continue to advance the technology to actually measure these things, you know, that's going to also be an important step in the long run.
Anything else you guys want to talk about today?
Is there anything else left to talk about? I don't know.
I don't know.
World peace?
No. Yeah.
I don't know. You want to talk about kids?
No, we'll lose all of our listeners.
Yeah, probably yeah. So.
Well, I think with that, we're getting about to the end of the podcast here. So I'm Ryan Miller.
Brad Carlson.
And we'd like to thank our special guest, Jill Sackett-Eberhart, and with Bowser. And thanks for listening.